From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, our foreign policy contributor on the Obama administration's lessons from Benghazi.
If the president is guilty, I think it's almost certainly more being too aloof and too disengaged and too focused on getting elected, which is how he became president of the United States twice now, rather than focusing on the details of policy.
How restorative practices can help move a community or a school past harm.
The bottom line of it is about building those relationships of trust and empathy and caring, which hopefully minimizes the violence.
And novelist Jess Walter's characters are flawed, but he doesn't write them off.
I think I have a fondness for my characters, too. I root for underdogs. I come from a small town and a very blue-collar background, and so I like people who rise to challenges.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today. The Obama administration has dealt with several major challenges in the foreign policy arena in the last couple of weeks. Hearings on how the State Department handled the uprising in Benghazi placed the administration's previous Secretary of State under a microscope. And the situation in Syria continues to deteriorate with a humanitarian crisis at hand. At the same time, the U.S. got some welcome news from the recent elections in Pakistan. Art Sear is our regular foreign policy contributor. He's director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Mitch. It's nice to be invited back, especially on your fine program.
Well, thanks so much for saying so. I want to start with Pakistan and one of the world's ongoing political potential flashpoints. How is the apparent election of Nawaz Sharif likely to affect the stability of the region?
I think it's a very great plus. Pakistan, as we all know, has had a vexed relationship with the United States, and anything like stable democracy, this is their first peaceful alternation in power of opposing parties. There was a lot of violence on Election Day, tragically, but that didn't stop the elections from going forward. This is part of a global trend that Americans should welcome.
There are complaints of vote rigging. There are all sorts of complaints of fraud. Is that likely to continue to play out? I mean, does it affect the legitimacy of the Sharif government, or do you think this is likely to die down?
I think it's likely to die down. I think there will, in certain districts, be elections, re-elections, especially where European Union observers who were there in force complained of voter intimidation, voter fraud, possible ballot box stuffing, the usual problems. We're not that far from Chicago that have characterized American politics until really fairly recently. The good news is that it was a decisive victory for Sharif and his party, which is Benazir Bhutto's party, the PPP. And even if there are some changes in vote totals, it's extremely unlikely that will change who won.
It is also being viewed with some sense of optimism from India. Is that correct?
Yeah. And that's perhaps the best news, given the history of tremendous tension long term. We have had alliance relations with both India and Pakistan, especially Pakistan, ironically, given recent news about Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. But India and Pakistan have been at odds since Pakistan was separated from newly independent India at the end of the 1940s. And the fact that New Delhi is making positive noises is something that we should all find reassuring.
How quickly do you think the United States has to engage the Sharif government as it forms a government?
Very quickly. I think we have ongoing communication because they are a close ally in the struggle against terrorist groups, in particular Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And I can assure you that the U.S. government, not just State Department officials, but AID officials, Pentagon officials, CIA people, all kinds of people are in continuing contact with their counterparts in the Pakistan government.
You mentioned State Department officials. This is as good a time as any to shift gears to the current microscope the Benghazi affair is under. And let me ask, what is your assessment of the way that affair, which took place some time ago, is now kind of being replayed in the hearing rooms of Capitol Hill?
Well, Greg Hicks, the self-described whistleblower who has been very blunt, unusually so for a career diplomat, in criticizing his superiors, that may well give it some political traction for the Republicans that it hasn't had before. My guess, but I'm keep in mind an academic sitting on the shores of Lake Michigan in a nice college. My guess is that if it was going to develop traction, it would have already in terms of partisan politics.
Well, and certainly I wonder how much traction it stands to gain with the American public absent some enormous smoking gun.
Yeah, exactly. Very well put. I think the administration and the department hierarchy were very shrewd in picking Thomas Pickering as the sort of point person and inspector general, in effect, of this case. Several people have resigned and others have been disciplined in the State Department hierarchy. Clearly, mistakes were made, as politicians like to say.
Again, sitting here on the shore of Lake Michigan, let me ask you this. Do you think the Obama administration erred greater as the situation played out or in its own evaluation and subsequent interpretation of it later?
I do think that a challenge for the administration, as for some previous presidents, is the perception, including on the part of sympathetic media people and allies in the wider society, that they're too clever by half in the midst of a campaign, putting too much emphasis, apparently, on political considerations over and above anything else. If the president is guilty, I think it's almost certainly more being too aloof and too disengaged and too focused on getting elected, which is how he became president of the United States, twice now, rather than focusing on the details of policy.
This also all played out under the previous Secretary of State. Does it have any impact on how John Kerry goes about his business?
I'm very glad that he's been appointed to that job. In many ways, it seems to me to be an ideal fit. I'm a great admirer of his. Let me underscore, he is a Vietnam combat veteran. He volunteered for missions. He didn't have to. He sought out danger. He could have, in his position, easily avoided the military. I'm very, very impressed by his record overall. And as you might have guessed, I voted for him in 2004. He does have, in contrast to Secretary Clinton, he does have, I think, the instincts and interest and background that is very helpful to traditional diplomacy, and that's still what makes the world work.
So you would say that Benghazi doesn't stick to him in some way?
No. It did happen under the previous Secretary of State, and I do believe sincerely that he'll do his best to pursue the public interest in this case. Obviously, the Republicans are trying to very, very aggressively to do some damage to Hillary Clinton's political prospects, especially because she's so enormously popular in the polls.
Let's shift to Syria, which is in the middle of crises of a variety of natures, a refugee crisis and a military crisis and a violence crisis, if you will. Is there any good end that you could see coming out of Syria? How does this likely play out?
Yes, the good end will be the collapse of the Assad regime eventually and the formation of a reasonably representative government in line with the trend that's going on elsewhere in the Middle East. It's interesting to me that at the joint press conference held yesterday involving the President and Prime Minister David Cameron of Great Britain, our closest ally in the world, that Cameron in particular spoke out forcefully but also in detail about the need to assist the rebellion in Syria. There is a broad global trend, which has now finally reached the Middle East, for representative government to grow. Professor Sam Huntington of Harvard, now deceased, but a very distinguished scholar over a very long career, wrote various perceptive books. The Clash of Civilizations became a bestseller in the 90s, and then an even bigger seller after 9/11 because he emphasized the cultural differences between the West and the Muslim world, among other regions of the world. A book that doesn't receive much attention is The Third Wave, which he wrote earlier back in the 80s, and which described in detail the tremendous long-term growth of democracy in the world.
It's been, I guess, about 5 months since the two of us sat down and talked about what the various foreign policy stories that would be on our radar screen in 2013 might be. And one that you mentioned was Turkey. And Turkey stands to play a huge role in the future direction of Syria, does it not?
Absolutely. Turkey has gotten corruption under control. They've gotten a much more efficient, productive economy underway. They're making their way in an area of traditional influence, Central Asia, as well as across the Mediterranean. They've had some tensions with Israel, normally a relatively close ally. Turkey's not an Arab country, but it is an Islamic country. And the security alliance with Israel was extremely important, remains important, and I'm very glad that President Obama ended his recent Mideast tour by dramatically but also effectively engineering a telephone call between the prime ministers of Turkey and Israel.
Let's shift to the other side of the world and a country that desperately would like to be seen as a power of some kind, and that is North Korea. Have we essentially just restarted the Cold War? Is there a new Cold War on in Korea?
In a way, it certainly is like dealing with them and reading about them is certainly like being in a time warp back to the height of the Cold War, the terrible Korean War, in this particularly fanatical and militarily very effective North Korean regime. But unlike the early 50s and unlike the 60s, 70s, and 80s for that matter, North Korea is a tremendously isolated country. They don't have a Soviet Union and a China backing them up.
Well, and is that the biggest upshot of this current situation, is that North Korea is in it totally alone?
In effect, they are. They make mischief in different places around the world. We've been talking about the Middle East. They were collaborating with Syria in building a nuclear facility, which the Israelis quite rightly and wisely took out, I believe with cooperation of American intelligence a little over 2 years ago. You name the vice, whether it's weapons, bootleg liquor, drugs, counterfeit currency, prostitution, the North Korean regime is involved in that kind of activity worldwide. They're a menace. I do, therefore, want to stress I'm convinced their days are numbered.
You say menace, and menace is different than using the term menace is different than using the term threat.
They're not really a direct military threat, despite all the media emphasis and, to some extent, hype on their primitive nuclear capabilities. The armistice in Korea that President Eisenhower was able to bring about through some very brutal measures at the start of his administration in 53, has held now for about 60 years. We're recognizing quite rightly the anniversary of that armistice this year. It's worth recognizing that event because the armistice has held. The Korean War made what had been a Europe and Germany-centered Cold War global. But the fact that North Korea is so isolated and South Korea is so extraordinarily successful underscores the wisdom and farsightedness of American foreign policy since the Truman administration.
How long do you think the North Korean situation can go on like this without something, some precipitating event bringing it to an end in some way or other?
I think they can continue to struggle, but they are struggling probably almost indefinitely. You'll remind me of that if they've collapsed 5 months from now, I'm sure, and you should. I've been going to South Korea since the mid-1980s, starting in 2003. People in the foreign ministry and elsewhere were concerned about the imminent collapse of North Korea. They were spending a lot of time and attention studying how the West Germans had handled the, in some ways, greater challenge of absorbing East Germany after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the fall of the Soviet Union. The fact that North Korea has been able to hold on so long shows how stoic the people are, but also how strong the army is and how strong its hold is on the population and the institutions they have. I think we're right to pay attention to changes at the top in the military structure as giving us some insight as to what's going on.
Well, we will keep an eye on it, and I will certainly remind you of what you're saying if things change in the next few months. But until then, Art Sear, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch. It's always a pleasure.
Art Sear is the Claussen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business and Director of the Claussen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha, and he joins us periodically to talk about foreign policy. The use of restorative practices to better foster a sense of community, it's being used internationally, but also right here at home. We'll learn about a focus on restorative practice in Milwaukee when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Restorative justice has gotten a lot of attention on the international stage, with bodies like South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission playing a large role in trying to foster a sense of national unity after a tumultuous period. But restorative practices are gaining traction at much more local levels right here in the Milwaukee community, in places you might not imagine, like Milwaukee Public Schools. The issue of seeking greater community harmony after a period of conflict or harm is at the center of the upcoming annual conference of the UW-Milwaukee Center for Urban Initiatives and Research. The center has studied the effectiveness of restorative practices in schools. Scott Davis is a researcher at the center. Sarah Kubitz is a social worker with Milwaukee Public Schools. And Paul Dudinsky is an assistant DA in the Milwaukee District Attorney's Office who works in violence prevention with MPS. All three are involved in planning the conference, and they're in the studio with us now. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
We should start with a definition. What are the sort of restorative practices that are at the heart of this conference coming up in May? What are we really talking about? The aftermath of violence, or is violence even necessarily a part of this?
Violence is only a part of it in the sense that we're all human and violence happens in communities of humans. But the bottom line of it is about building those relationships of trust and empathy and caring, which hopefully minimizes the violence.
You know, in the criminal justice system, there are a number of forms of justice. One is a punitive, retributive form of justice. We often view that as incarcerating folks who have made really bad decisions, committed violent crimes, committed sexual assaults, crimes of those natures. We also have rehabilitative justice. Rehabilitative justice commonly seen at our children's court center. But it's also a major part of the criminal justice system. Virtually everyone who's placed on probation or faces a term of parole, there are goals for that person to achieve. One might be obtaining their high school diploma, following through with counseling to address their needs, rehab, learning. Rehabilitation is all about learning. The third piece is the restorative justice. And the restorative justice, like Sarah just mentioned, is really heavy on accountability. It's about sometimes putting people eye-to-eye accountability, not just with the judge, but sometimes with someone who's been harmed, sometimes with peers in a community. Certainly in the criminal justice system, it might be with a victim or a surrogate victim, but in our schools, a lot of times it's about young people facing their peers, and that can be really difficult for them. So these different types of justice you often think about. And sometimes it's hard to define what restorative justice is without looking at some of the other types of justice, like retributive and rehabilitative justice.
Well, and frankly, sometimes it's hard to get our heads around what justice is at all. But I wonder if it's oversimplifying things to talk about restorative justice in the terms that it is the one of those three of those versions of justice that most involves either a victim or some person or group of people that has been on the receiving end of a negative action.
Yeah, oftentimes we might think of crime in the criminal justice system as involving a violation of the law, a violation of the state, violation in a school setting of rules. In restorative justice, crime or an offense is really seen as a violation of people, a violation of relationships. And those relationships now, they need to be restored. Or at very least, the person who's harmed someone else has an obligation to repair. Has quite frankly a responsibility to repair. It doesn't necessarily help people when they don't get that opportunity and follow through with that obligation.
Well, and what are some real world examples of this in a school setting? I mean, it's fairly easy to wrap our heads around the idea of restorative practices in when we're talking about, you know, a burglary or a sexual assault or a violent crime of some kind. But what are we talking about when this is applied within the context of a school system?
Maybe, Sarah, you might want to give an example. I do want to tell you one thing, Mitch. We're really, really careful. You mentioned, say, a sexual assault. That might not be at all a case that we would take up with a restorative justice angle because of the power and control dynamics that are present in a domestic violence or sexual abuse case. You know, even burglary cases, people who feel violated in that way, that their home has been violated. Sexual abuse, obviously going to be a violation of my body. as a victim. But it can be very, very emotional for some folks. This would never be something, obviously, that we'd want to foist. But interestingly enough, we have a lot of victims who will step forward and say, you know what, I want to meet this person who committed this crime. And that happens, whether the person is incarcerated or someone else who is in the community one way, shape or form.
But so let's go back then to the school setting. How is this being applied? How are restorative practices being applied in this case?
So often in the school setting, there's he said, she said, and what ends up in an ugly mess often started as a simple he said, she said. And when and this is getting back to the idea that restorative practices is about building that sense of community and restoring that sense of connection that we have by virtue of being human beings, which gets messed up all the time. The focus is on how do we help students know each other as people so that they won't want to harm each other in the first place, so that if they do have a question about who did what or who said what to them, they have a way to address that. And so a lot of the cases that we take do come from those sorts of situations.
Yeah, and from my standpoint, it's interesting because as a prosecutor, usually I'm used to being in a reactive place. The crime has already occurred. Perhaps the investigation, the arrest has been completed. And at that point in time, one of those cases flows to my office and we make a charging decision and then a person is in court. And here in the restorative justice, you get an opportunity up front to work with people. And in the schools, just last week, we had a young person that came to one of the circles at Rufus King High School. Very impressive. Not only the student who came to that circle had a lot of courage to face his peers, but the peers in the circle, the tremendous amount of leadership that I saw from them. They gave him excellent advice. They gave him some difficult advice. In many ways, some of that advice to him was uncomfortable. He probably would have been easier for him to actually take the suspension that afternoon rather than facing his peers. They gave him some, you know, they gave him some difficult judgments, but they were judgments that he had to hear. And you know what? He didn't hear them that day from the adults. He heard them from his peers, which to me showed the influence that these young people can have on their own school community. And afterwards, I tell you, Mitch, these kids are excited. They are juiced up because they feel like they're making a difference. They're making a change. And in a way, they feel like they own their community.
Scott Davis, I wanted to turn to you because this conference is being convened by the Center for Urban Initiatives and Research in partnership with some other groups. Why is this part of your charge?
Well, for the last, say, 15 years or so, we've had a urban initiatives conference for the community. And really, it's about applied practices and principles that various groups can use and take away with them. Through my work with Milwaukee Public Schools and the Safe Schools, Healthy Students Initiative, I was actually introduced to restorative justice and restorative practices. And one of the things that as I was evaluating, you know, what is the impact, what is working, what processes seem to be working, this one seemed to – it was very interesting to me. It seemed to be doing something. And what it was, I wasn't quite sure. So we did some pretty intensive research on a comparison of restorative practices schools versus schools that are not doing it across a variety of different areas. And this is kind of a long way to get back at the question you had asked about what type of offenses. We tracked and we continue to track when restorative practice circles are happening, including how many students are served and the reasons. And in 2009, 2010, and 11, 10 to 11, there were classroom disruptions, bullying, fighting, disrespective language, truancy, a whole variety of issues. It's not just a violent offense or just someone who's not behaving in class. It was a variety. And it was very interesting. We used a matched subjects design where we matched a school who's receiving restorative practices with those that aren't. And we had some criteria. They had to have the restorative practices in place for at least 2 years. And the findings were very interesting and to me suggested that this could be very promising. And just some examples, we looked at disciplinary incidents, and those are the behaviors of the youth in the school. And in terms of the restorative practices schools, they went down 49%. In comparison, the non-restorative schools only went down 15%. And just in terms of sheer numbers, it went from just under 2,000 for the restorative practices schools in the first year to just under 1,000. So it went down by 1,000. In terms of personal and physical safety, another really interesting finding there, restorative practices schools decreased their number of personal safety incidents by 11%, whereas it increased in the non-restorative schools by 4%. So one of the things we wanted to do that was really interesting in and of itself, we wanted to look a little bit more specifically at a couple of different instances. They were in parallel with not only restorative practices but some of the initiatives that MPS was actually as a district working on. One of them is classroom disruptions, which has somewhat of a generic definition. But really right there, a 41% decrease in the restorative practices schools compared to only 11% decrease in the non-restorative schools. And in fighting, it went down 26% for restorative practices schools and up 9% in the non. So something was happening in those schools. The classrooms were less disruptive. The fighting incidents were going down. And in general, the restorative practices schools started at higher points and were at the end were below the non. Bottom line is these are very promising. A lot of these are not statistically significant. However, I think we need to not lose sight that these are very practically significant because these are trends that I think MPS and our students and our teachers and our people in the community really need to see that these practices can be implemented in a school setting and a variety of other settings to really make this happen.
Maybe not statistically significant enough to draw conclusions, but statistically significant enough to warrant further study.
Exactly. And it was based on these findings that we were planning our 2013 conference, and we felt that this is such an important activity that can happen in our community in light of a lot of different things. You had mentioned violence earlier on, and Milwaukee, we have a history of violence here, and we've had some pretty atrocious incidents lately. And we just felt that this was a really good area to not always work about dealing with the tragedy afterward. Maybe is there something that we can do on the front end to prevent it? And so what we did is we put together our restorative practices conference, and it's going to happen on May 29th here in Milwaukee at the Italian Community Center. And we're all coming together with sort of two foci in mind. One would be repairing harm on the individual level, which I think is how a lot of people stereotypically think of restorative practices. But then we want to move into repairing harm on a community level. And what we feel is a good place to talk is Arno Michaelis and Pardeep Kalika from Serve to Unite. They are going to talk about the Sikh temple shootings that happened about a year ago. And I think it's an interesting companion people. Arno was a former white supremacist skinhead who has turned around and now he's about peace and building the community. And Pardeep, with his father and his family and relatives and friends with the temple the shooting that they had to survive, he, instead of turning bitter, he's turned it around to how we can fix it. So we feel that this is a really good opportunity for the community to learn about this instead of just the restorative justice from the law angle.
So let me ask all of you this. Who are you hoping will be there and what do you hope that they do with what they learn that day?
We're going to have a variety of people, I think. What's really neat about what UWM, the Center for Urban Initiatives and Research, has done is they've really looked at restorative justice and said, who are the professionals? Who are the different professionals that are utilizing it? And so you've highlighted a breadth and a scope of people. So I think this is going to be attractive whether you're utilizing restorative practices as a judge or whether you're utilizing it as a prosecutor, a probation or parole agent, if you're utilizing it as a school teacher or a school social worker or a school psychologist or as a principal, I think you're going to get people also from the community. You mentioned Arno and Pardeep. You're going to get people from the community that have been working and using this type of powerful circle work. I think they're going to those people are going to really be a part of this. I see this as a conference, but I really see it as a summit of bringing together people to really share these ideas. And I think this is a great leadership, not only by UWM, but for Milwaukee, for this community.
Just in terms of who's come to the table, we at UWM are partnering with the Medical College of Wisconsin, their violence prevention initiative. And that's, I think, in and of itself is a great for at least for me at the center is a new direction where we're reaching out to the wider academic community. We have individuals that are coming who are faculty at various universities. We have people who are coming from Milwaukee Public Schools that might be teachers, that might be paraprofessionals, that might be social workers, that might be administrators. We have people who are coming from law enforcement. It could be some people from the judicial system. Paul Dudinsky from the DA's office, they've been a part of planning this process the entire time before and after. And to get it, I think Paul answered it really well. Anyone who might have an interest or might be using this, I think will find this very valuable.
And it's great. District 3 Milwaukee Police Department officers are meeting with youth, talking about issues and sharing back and forth. And I personally feel like you can tell that the level of respect has gone up. The level of trust has gone up between folks. Sarah mentioned earlier that word connectedness. You can feel that. Here's a group of young people that came into this circle with some pretty strong opinions about law enforcement. And the Milwaukee Police Department officers who came in here, they came in here very open and very willing to listen and to have an exchange, to describe, to explain, but really to listen. And I felt that was the strongest piece. I was very impressed with those officers who came in there and were open to listen to those youth. As you mentioned, law enforcement, I think they would be just a terrific group to attend the conference as well.
Well, whether you call it a conference or a summit, it sounds like pretty remarkable work. And Scott and Paul and Sarah, best of luck with it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul Dudinsky is an assistant DA in the Milwaukee District Attorney's Office. Sarah Kubitz is a social worker at Milwaukee Public Schools. And Scott Davis is a researcher at UW-Milwaukee's Center for Urban Initiatives and Research. The center's conference on restorative practices is scheduled for May 29th. You'll find a link to more information at uwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then writer Jess Walter talks about the flawed but redeeming characters that populate his latest novel and most of his fiction. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. There is a review of Jess Walter's latest book that describes the author as, quote, a big-hearted man who excels at writing about other big-hearted, if broken, men. Walter would plead guilty as charged. The review is actually of his latest short story collection, but it could easily apply to his most recent novel as well. Beautiful Ruins is just out in paperback and is filled with flawed characters who themselves are filled with humanity. The book brings together divergent characters, storylines, and even eras from World War II Italy to modern-day Hollywood. The tale is woven together convincingly and with much good humor. We'll hear Jess Walter read a bit from it later, but he joins us now to share his own story. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks, Mitch.
How would you describe the kind of characters that you're most drawn to, either the ones you most like to read about or the ones you most like to create?
Oh, you know, I think I'm probably more drawn to flawed characters than I often have people say, you know, why are your characters so troubled? And they seem perfectly normal to me. So but I think like a lot of authors, I like to sort of work out existential questions and philosophical questions and psychological questions through the characters. So often they're troubled by things that work their way into the narrative.
They're troubled, but they're not. Sort of outrageously troubled. These are kind of normal, flawed people.
Yeah, and I think I have a fondness for my characters too. I root for underdogs. I come from a small town and a very blue collar background, and so I like people who rise to challenges. To me, you know, a father who you know, is homeless and has to beg for money to buy his son in foster care a present is more interesting than, you know, a wealthy lawyer who comes home from the golf course and finds out his son has gotten into Yale. I'll just always be drawn to those harder cases, probably.
Well, and it's funny because we might think of the latter case, the father who comes back home,
right,
after the,
yeah,
the lawyer father, or whatever, is as being kind of the larger character. But the larger than life people are the ones who you really kind of get into.
Yeah, you know, I like people who face all sorts of challenges. And in Beautiful Ruins, for instance, I think a lot of the challenges are created by the characters themselves, by their own appetites and their ambitions and their dreams. And those kind of characters really inspire me. But also, just coming from the background I do, I'm really inspired by people who have economic hardship, who you know, who don't have the advantages that some other characters do.
There are any number of big-hearted and or broken characters in the book, some beautiful ruins, if
yeah,
you will. When you go back to the beginning of the process, what was the ruin that first got lodged in your head? Or do you even work that way?
You know, I really don't work that way. For me, fiction is a series of holes that kind of open up. I start digging around. And the very first image I had is the image that starts the book, which is a woman arriving in this Italian village that you can only reach by boat. And for a couple of years, I didn't know who these people were. I just knew that she was beautiful and he was smitten. And those characters, Dee Murray, an actress who's been exiled from the set of the film Cleopatra, and Pasquale Tursi, this Italian innkeeper, were the real constants for the book. Finding out who those people are, you dig and dig, and the more you get to know them, you realize the sort of question that their lives pose. And the novel ventures over a bunch of different characters. It has real breadth as you meet all these people who connect to their lives in certain ways. But at the heart of it was always those two people, Pasquale and Dee, and their and the idea that the moment where they met would be so powerful for both of them that it would define their lives.
It's fortunate you were a fiction writer, because that could easily have been the setup for a perfume commercial.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't. It was, yeah. No, I was always interested in the difference between the vision of the life that you imagine, the dream, and the life that you end up living. There's a moment where Pasquale realizes that his life now will always be two lives, the one that he leads and the one that he doesn't. And those roads not taken, the idea of regret. And when the title Beautiful Ruins hit me, I realized that there was a sort of dignity and power and honor to the life that you choose, even if it isn't the dream that you imagined in the beginning. And that's what I was really writing toward.
Well, and regret really underlies almost everyone in this book.
I think it underlies everyone in life. You know, I don't, you know, I'm not playing in the NBA as I had hoped when I was 9 years old. So, yeah, I think for a lot of us, coming to terms with the sacrifices we make, the decisions we make, and you know, I think I started this book in 1997, and I lost a parent and had a couple of children and had one move out of the house. And you experience that much sort of life and heartache, and also the sort of everyday triumph, and that's what I wanted the characters to sort of experience. And so I think this book probably has more breadth and more of a longer tale than most of the books I've written, because that's what the characters experience.
This might be one of those things that I may just be ascribing more significance to it than anything, but there is something almost poetic in so much regret playing out in place places that are so sun-drenched and so physically beautiful. A lot of this book takes place in the seaside village in Italy. Some of it takes place in California. These are places where externally everything kind of goes with a veneer of beauty.
Yeah, no, I think that's perceptive. There, it's very much, you know, the settings of had a sort of romanticism that I wanted to explore, even though I think of myself as a kind of anti-romantic in a way. And the book is very much about our romantic ideal of the places and the people. So it begins in this village, Porto Vergogna, in the part of Italy called the Cinque Terre, the Five Lands, that is these villages etched into the cliffs, these fishing village that I invented. And then it moves to Hollywood, you know, another a place that connects, of course, with dreams because it's where they all go. And it moves to Edinburgh, Scotland, and, you know, a mountain resort in North Idaho, and it really sort of hopscotches the world.
You kind of alluded to this, you know, as I read the book, one of the issues that stuck with me is that the characters who populate it, you have an innkeeper in this tiny village, you have sort of a failed writer from Wisconsin,
right.
Actually,
yeah, right.
A film producer, a movie mogul, a would-be screenwriter, a 1960s movie star, and a struggling rock musician. It is no small accomplishment that you were able to weave their lives together.
Yeah. Again, it's sometimes when I'll try to explain a book, I'll feel like, you know, there should be congressional hearings or something. I should have a lawyer whispering in my ear. On the advice of counsel, I can't answer that because it's almost impossible to defend the choices you make. I found myself inventing this actress, and she was in Italy in 1962, and I thought, what's she doing in Italy in 1962? And that leads me to research Cleopatra, the film that was being made there, and. But I think, you know, I always was trying to find characters that who were striving in certain ways. And, you know, one thing would lead to another. One bit of research would lead to the next. I think one of the reasons the book took so long was weaving all those stories together. I always thought of it as a sort of braided story, these strands coming in and out but hopefully forming a whole, and that whole being a kind of, you know, a story that about not just the people in their lives but about a kind of thematic connection that they all have too.
There is one of the characters in Beautiful Ruins, Alvis Bender, who has been coming to this little seaside village in Italy for years to write, but he has only ever written a single chapter of this would-be masterpiece in his mind.
Yeah.
Was there a point at which that was – Beautiful Ruins was that book in your mind?
Yeah, that's an illustration of kind of how the book worked for me exactly. I was stuck with one chapter just as Alvis Bender is stuck with one chapter. I had two problems really. I had in my mind the idea that this villa, that this hotel should be called the Hotel Adequate View, which struck me as funny but also sort of wistful, and I'm a pretty wistful writer. So the other problem was that I was stuck with one chapter, a woman checking into the Hotel Adequate View in a village I'd made up in Italy. And if you know anything about Italians, you know that understatement is not a hallmark of especially Italian males. So trying to figure out how this innkeeper had named his hotel the Hotel Adequate View, I realized I needed an American. And so being stuck on one chapter, I sent an American with the problem I'd had, which was that he was Alvis Bender, a former Wisconsin car salesman and English teacher who, which sometimes feels like the cross of a novelist is half car salesman, half English teacher. So, I sent Alvis Bender to solve my narrative problems. And along the way, I was in Scotland for the Edinburgh Fringe and Book Festival and found myself contemplating questions of beauty and art that, you know, that the character Pat later contemplate. So in a way, because the book took those 15 years, I very much found myself incorporating my own writing life into it.
As it existed as a single chapter for so long, how did you come to the conclusion that it was a novel and not a short story?
Well, you know, I every time I would return to it, I would tear it down from the beginning. There isn't a sentence that existed as it did then. But as with most people, I think for a fiction writer, the elemental thing, the thing at the very beginning is character. And these people, Dee and Pasquale, especially Pasquale, who was lived in this small provincial town and dreamed of turning a small fishing village into a resort teeming with Americans and Canadians and Marilyn Monroe on his beach, you know, and him dumping loads of construction sand and having the waves take them away and imagining he could build a tennis court in the cliffs until Dee points out to him that the tennis balls will be bobbing in the ocean if people miss them. And that sort of dreamer, that unlikely dreamer, I connected with, again, coming from Spokane, Washington. I still live in the town I was born in. And so Pasquale, someone who believes life is going to pass him over, was a character that I just couldn't let go of. And so every time I finished five other novels in those 15 years, and every time I finished one, I would say, all right, what other arrows do I have in the quiver? And I would always find myself returning to a book that was called at various times The Hotel Adequate View and all sorts of things before it became Beautiful Ruins.
There is this wonderful passage delivered mainly by the somewhat inebriated Alvis Bender as he's kind of lecturing Pasquale about what writers do, and I was hoping you might share it with us.
Sure. Pasquale didn't understand what Alvis Bender meant by these writers inventing. He thought of inventors as men like Marconi, the great Bolognese who'd invented the wireless. Once the first story was told, what was there to invent? Excellent question. Since losing his college teaching job, Alvis was always looking for opportunities to lecture, and in the sheltered teenage Pasquale, he found a willing audience. Imagine truth is a chain of great mountains, many surfaces and peaks, valleys, their tops way up in the clouds. Writers explore these truths, always looking out for new paths up these peaks. So the stories are paths, Pasquale asked. No, Alvis said. Stories are bulls. Riders come of age full of vigor, and they feel the need to drive the old stories from the herd. One bull rules the herd for a while, but then he loses his vigor and the young bulls take over. Stories are bulls. Nope. Alvis Bender took a drink. Stories are nations, empires. They can last as long as ancient Rome or as short as the Third Reich. Story nations rise and decline, governments change, trends rise, and they go on conquering their neighbors. Like the Roman Empire, the epic poem stretched for centuries as far as the world. The novel rose with the British Empire. But wait, what is that rising in America? Film? Pasquale grinned. And if I ask if stories are empires, you'll say, stories are people. I'm a story. You're a story. Your father is a story. Our stories go in every direction. They die out, crash, bump into one another. But sometimes, if we're lucky, our stories join into one, and for a while we're less alone. But you never answered the question, Pasquale said, why you come here. Bender pondered the wine in his hand. A writer needs four things to achieve greatness, Pasquale. Desire, disappointment, and the sea. That's only three. Alvis finished his wine. You have to do disappointment twice.
Jess Walter reading from Beautiful Ruins. Thanks. Did you spend time in Italy as this came together?
Yeah. My wife is second-generation Italian, so I went the first time in 1997, and we ventured up and down the boot, and then we staggered into the Cinque Terre in the middle of the off-season when it was pouring rain and when there were no other tourists around. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to write about it in the 1960s. And so I started the novel in 97. I went back a couple of times. My Italian publisher dragged me to Italy one time, so I snuck back to the Cinque Terre and did some more research. And then I finished a draft in about 2008, but it wasn't right. I didn't have the book, so I went back to Italy and found myself back at the Cinque Terre, really immersing myself and trying to find my way back into the story.
You were comparing Porto Vergogna, which Port of Shame,
yes, right.
To Spokane, which is obviously a much larger metropolitan area. Did it surprise you, the commonality you felt?
Yeah. You know, I think it's a way to write about characters to find a kind of emotional purchase, something that you connect with that isn't exactly the same but is similar. Someone asked Marilyn Robinson, the great novelist, one time which of her characters she identified with. And she said, oh, my goodness, all of them. And so Pasquale is a much more drastic version of the sort of isolation that I felt living in my hometown, but a very similar isolation. The same way Dee Murray's ambition and her fear that she's missed the boat was something I could connect with. Alvis Bender's creative crisis is something I've felt a million times. Pat Bender's trying to tame his demons is something anyone can identify with. So I usually can find some peace, even though it can be more exaggerated in the characters.
So I won't bother asking you which of your characters you can identify
with. Yeah, I mean, you find a bit of them that you can find some place with, but then they surprise you there. I'm always surprised who they turn out to be, and that's the great fun of it. I don't think it's that different describing writing. Anyone who loves books understands what it is to be a writer, which is to be so swept away by the story that you have what a fiction writer calls surprising inevitability, where you didn't expect something to happen, but it seemed like it had to happen that way. And I don't know how many times I'll be writing and a character will seem to have that surprising inevitability, something that I didn't even really see coming.
Well, and I wonder if this many years into your writing career, you are better at disguising your own or hiding your own commonalities with your characters than perhaps when you started?
I don't know. I have I have this short story collection out now, some of those stories are seem nakedly autobiographical. I always feel like the more the character resembles me in the exterior, sometimes the less they do in the interior. I wrote about a mafia member in the witness protection program named Vince Camden in my novel Citizen Vince, who in some ways feels like the most nakedly autobiographical character I've ever written about, even though I've never killed anyone or been involved in the mob. But some of the thoughts that he had were so close to the things that I've thought. And so, sometimes I'll be surprised and, you know, by things that'll bubble up within the characters, surprised in both ways, that they connect so much to something I've felt and that they seem so alien to me and yet in a way that I can understand. And I think more and more, and you asked about my age as a writer, I've come to think of writing and reading as an act of empathy, of being able to crawl inside someone else's skin. And we can do that both by recognizing ourselves in them and by recognizing them in the way they don't resemble us too.
Well, it's terrific stuff. Jess Walter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jess Walter's latest novel is called Beautiful Ruins. It's just out in paperback. He also has a recent short story collection called We Live in Water. Walter lives in Spokane, Washington. He was in Milwaukee last week for a reading at Boswell Book Company. That is the Tuesday edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, we'll meet the woman in charge of a huge swath of the nation's forests, the regional forester for Region 9 of the U.S. Forest Service. That includes the Midwest and the whole northeastern part of the country, and it's headquartered here in Milwaukee. I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.